Chapter 31. Gould, are you aware to what point he has idealized the existence, the worth, the meaning of the Santo mine? Are you aware of it? He must have known what he was talking about. The effect he expected was produced. Mrs. Gould, ready to take fire, gave it up suddenly with a low little sound that resembled a moan. What do you know? She asked in a feeble voice. Nothing, answered Deckard, firmly. But then, don't you see, he's an Englishman? Well, what of that? Asked Mrs. Gould. Simply that he cannot act or exist without idealizing every simple feeling, desire, or achievement. He could not believe his own motives if he did not make them first a part of some fairy tale. The earth is not quite good enough for him, I fear. Do you excuse my frankness? Besides, whether you excuse it or not, it is part of the truth of things which hurts the, what do you call them, the Anglo-Saxon susceptibilities, and at the present moment I don't feel as if I could treat seriously either his conception of things, or if you allow me to say so, or yet yours. Mrs. Gould gave no sign of being offended. I suppose Antonia understands you thoroughly? Understands? Well, yes. But I am not sure that she approves. That, however, makes no difference. I am honest enough to tell you that, Mrs. Gould. Your idea, of course, is separation, she said. Separation, of course, declared Martin. Why yes, separation of the whole Occidental province from the rest of the unquiet body. But my true idea, the only one I care for, is not to be separated from Antonia. And that is all? Asked Mrs. Gould, without severity. Absolutely. I am not deceiving myself about my motives. She won't leave Sulaco for my sake, therefore Sulaco must leave the rest of the Republic to its fate. Nothing could be clearer than that. I like a clearly defined situation. I cannot part with Antonia, therefore the one and indivisible Republic of Costaguana must be made to part with its western province. Fortunately, it happens to be also a sound policy. The richest, the most fertile part of this land may be saved from anarchy. Personally, I care little, very little, but it's a fact that the establishment of Montero in power would mean death to me. In all the proclamations of general pardon which I have seen, my name, with a few others, is specially excepted. The brothers hate me, as you know very well, Mrs. Gould, and behold, here is the rumor of them having won a battle. You say that supposing it is true, I have plenty of time to run away. The slight, protesting murmur on the part of Mrs. Gould made him pause for a moment, while he looked at her with a somber and resolute glance. Ah, but I would, Mrs. Gould. I would run away, if it served that which at present is my only desire. I am courageous enough to say that, and to do it too. But women, even our women, are idealists. It is Antonia that won't run away. A novel sort of vanity. You call it vanity, said Mrs. Gould, in a shocked voice. Say pride, then, which, Father Corbelin would tell you, is a mortal sin. But I am not proud. I am simply too much in love to run away. At the same time I want to live. There is no love for a dead man. Therefore it is necessary that Sulaco should not recognize the victorious Montero. And you think my husband will give you his support? I think he can be drawn into it, like all idealists, when he once sees a sentimental basis for his action. But I wouldn't talk to him. Mere clear facts won't appeal to his sentiment. It is much better for him to convince himself in his own way. And, frankly, I could not, perhaps, just now pay sufficient respect to either his motives or even, perhaps, to yours, Mrs. Gould. It was evident that Mrs. Gould was very determined not to be offended. She smiled vaguely, while she seemed to think the matter over. As far as she could judge from the girl's half-confidences, Antonia understood that young man. Obviously there was promise of safety in his plan, or rather in his idea. Moreover, right or wrong, the idea could do no harm. and it was quite possible, also, that the rumor was false. You have some sort of a plan, she said. Simplicity itself. Berrios has started. Let him go on then. He will hold Keita, which is the door of the sea route to Sulaco. They cannot send a sufficient force over the mountains. No, not even to cope with the band of Hernandez. Meantime we shall organize our resistance here. And for that, this very Hernandez will be useful. He has defeated troops as a bandit. He will no doubt accomplish the same thing, if he is made a colonel, or even a general. You know the country well enough not to be shocked by what I say, Mrs. Gould. I have heard you assert that this poor bandit was the living, breathing example of cruelty, injustice, stupidity, and oppression that ruin men's souls as well as their fortunes in this country. Well, there would be some poetical retribution in that man arising to crush the evils which had driven an honest ranchero into a life of crime. A fine idea of retribution in that, isn't there? Decada dropped easily into English, which he spoke with precision, very correctly, but with too many Z sounds. Think also of your hospitals, of your schools, of your ailing mothers and feeble old men, of all that population which you and your husband have brought into the rocky gorge of Santome. Are you not responsible to your conscience for all these people? Is it not worth while to make another effort, which is not at all so desperate as it looks, rather than, Deckard finished his thought with an upward toss of the arm, suggesting annihilation, and Mrs. Gould turned away her head with a look of horror. Why don't you say all this to my husband, she asked, without looking at Deckard, who stood watching the effect of his words. Ah, but Don Carlos is so English, he began. Mrs. Gould interrupted, leave that alone, Don Martin. He's as much a Costaguanero, no. He's more of a Costaguanero than yourself. Sentimentalist, sentimentalist, Deckard almost cooed, in a tone of gentle and soothing deference. Sentimentalist, after the amazing manner of your people. I have been watching El Rey de Sulaco since I came here on a fool's errand, and perhaps impelled by some treason of fate lurking behind the unaccountable turns of a man's life. But I don't matter, I am not a sentimentalist, I cannot endow my personal desires with a shining robe of silk and jewels. Life is not for me a moral romance derived from the tradition of a pretty fairy tale. No, Mrs. Gould, I am practical. I am not afraid of my motives. But, pardon me, I have been rather carried away. What I wish to say is that I have been observing. I won't tell you what I have discovered, no. That is unnecessary, whispered Mrs. Gould, once more averting her head. It is. Except one little fact, that your husband does not like me. It's a small matter, which, in the circumstances, seems to acquire a perfectly ridiculous importance. Ridiculous and immense, for, clearly, money is required for my plan, he reflected, then added, meaningly, and we have two sentimentalists to deal with. I don't know that I understand you, Don Martin, said Mrs. Gould, coldly, preserving the low key of their conversation. But, speaking as if I did, who is the other? The great Holroyd in San Francisco, of course, Deckard whispered, lightly. I think you understand me very well. Women are idealists, but then they are so perspicacious. But whatever was the reason of that remark, disparaging and complimentary at the same time, Mrs. Gould seemed not to pay attention to it. The name of Holroyd had given a new tone to her anxiety. The silver escort is coming down to the harbor tomorrow. A whole 6 months working, Don Martin, she cried in dismay. Let it come down, then, breathed out Deckard, earnestly, almost into her ear. But if the rumor should get about, and especially if it turned out true, troubles might break out in the town, objected Mrs. Gould. Deckard admitted that it was possible. He knew well the town children of the Sulaco Campo. Sullen, thievish, vindictive, and bloodthirsty, whatever great qualities their brothers of the plain might have had. But then there was that other sentimentalist, who attached a strangely idealistic meaning to concrete facts. This stream of silver must be kept flowing north, to return in the form of financial backing from the great house of Holrud. Up at the mountain in the strong room of the mine, the silver bars were worth less for his purpose than so much lead, from which at least bullets may be run. Let it come down to the harbor, ready for shipment. The next north-going steamer would carry it off for the very salvation of the Santome mine, which had produced so much treasure. And, moreover, the rumor was probably false, he remarked, with much conviction in his hurried tone. Besides, Sonora, concluded Deckard, we may suppress it for many days. I have been talking with the telegraphist in the middle of the Plaza Mayor, thus I am certain that we could not have been overheard. There was not even a bird in the air near us. And also let me tell you something more. I have been making friends with this man called Nostromo, the Capitas. We had a conversation this very evening, I walking by the side of his horse as he rode slowly out of the town just now. He promised me that, if a riot took place for any reason, even for the most political of reasons, you understand his cargadors, an important part of the populace, you will admit, should be found on the side of the Europeans. He has promised you that? Mrs. Gould inquired, with interest. What made him make that promise to you? Upon my word, I don't know, declared Deckard, in a slightly surprised tone. He certainly promised me that, but now you ask me why, I could not tell you his reasons. He talked with his usual carelessness, which, if he had been anything else but a common sailor, I would call a poser and affectation. Deckard, interrupting himself, looked at Mrs. Gould curiously. Upon the whole, he continued, I suppose he expects something to his advantage from it. You mustn't forget that he does not exercise his extraordinary power over the lower classes without a certain amount of personal risk, and without a great profusion in spending his money. One must pay in some way or other for such a solid thing as individual prestige. He told me, after we made friends at a dance, in a posada kept by a Mexican just outside the walls, that he had come here to make his fortune. I suppose he looks upon his prestige as a sort of investment. Perhaps he prizes it for its own sake, Mrs. Gould said in a tone, as if she were repelling an undeserved aspersion. Viviola, the Garibaldino, with whom he has lived for some years, calls him the incorruptible. Ah, he belongs to the group of your protégés out there towards the harbor, Mrs. Gould. My bean. And Captain Mitchell calls him wonderful. I have heard no end of tales of his strength, his audacity, his fidelity. No end of fine things. H'm, incorruptible. It is indeed a name of honor for the capitas of the cargadors of Sulaco. Incorruptible. Fine, but vague. However, I suppose he's sensible too. And I talked to him upon that sane and practical assumption. I prefer to think him disinterested, and therefore trustworthy, Mrs. Gould said, with the nearest approach to curtness it was in her nature to assume. Well, if so, then the silver will be still more safe. Let it come down, Sonora. Let it come down, so that it may go north and return to us in the shape of credit. Mrs. Gould glanced along the corridor towards the door of her husband's room. Deckard, watching her as if he had his fate in her hands, detected an almost imperceptible nod of assent. He bowed with a smile, and, putting his hand into the breast pocket of his coat, pulled out a fan of light feathers set upon painted leaves of sandalwood. I had it in my pocket, he murmured, triumphantly, for a plausible pretext. He bowed again. Good night, Sonora. Mrs. Gould continued along the corridor away from her husband's room. The fate of the Santome mine was lying heavy upon her heart. It was a long time now since S. he had begun to fear it. It had been an idea. S. he had watched it with misgivings turning into a fetish, and now the fetish had grown into a monstrous and crushing weight. It was as if the inspiration of their early years had left her heart to turn into a wall of silver bricks erected by the silent work of evil spirits between her and her husband. He seemed to dwell alone within a circumvallation of precious metal, leaving her outside with her school, her hospital, the sick mothers and the feeble old men, mere insignificant vestiges of the initial inspiration. "Those poor people," she murmured to herself. Below, she heard the voice of Martin Deckard in the patio speaking loudly. "I have found Donna Antonia's fan, Basilio. Look. Here it is. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter."